Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 170, featuring Sébastien de Guy, or Sébastien de Guy. From Algorithmic. He is the founder and CEO of Algorithmic, which is the maker of what product? Which is most known for which product?
Substance Painter, Substance Designer, yep. Substance.
Yeah, which is a really interesting tool because tools like this, like what they have had existed for years, but was never really sort of like the aha moment, right? It seems to me that Substance...
Oh, they nailed it.
They nailed it.
Yeah.
There's something about it that's really, really good in terms of creating procedurals that are correct. And what's interesting, or look good, what's interesting in this podcast is that a lot of that came from Sebastian's work for his PhD, where he basically made a mistake. So it's like bad fractals, in a sense. I don't want to say bad fractals, but incorrect fractals or incorrect equations gave him interesting results that will allow for things to look a little bit more easy to control and natural to look. So really
it's
interesting.
A perfect happy accident.
Yeah, yeah. And he and I are both math guys, and we love math. So be warned that this is math-centric in a lot of ways, which I think is a good thing, because we talk a lot about the math, and he tells some personal stories about how he figured out certain things and about random numbers and all that. Randomness is a big part of it, because that's how everything gets done, is through randomness, right? Really cool. And they did this at Vertex, which was in London. So it was also really fun to do that. Lots of fun. And I think that they'll probably have him back at some point, because it's really, really great conversation with him. Super nice guy. Super nice. Now, Lon, we have a couple of announcements. We're moving forward fast to try to get the Total Chaos stuff.
Yeah, Total Chaos is coming up quick. Mm-hmm. It's May 18th and 19th in Sofia.
Yep.
And so there's tickets available for masterclasses and so on. It's a great lineup.
Those are going quick, though. So if you sign up for masterclasses, you do that really quickly.
Just got back from NAB.
Yes.
Did a little bit of time in the Google booth, the Google Cloud booth,
mm-hmm.
showing off brand new V-Ray Cloud.
Right.
So that was exciting to be able to show it, albeit it's kind of a silly demo.
Is it?
Because... You hit the button, it renders on the cloud. Yay, button.
Right.
So it's, it's really that easy.
But it really is. You literally just hit the button and it renders on the cloud.
So we've started the early access program for that, for people to check it out.
Yep.
Really exciting stuff. Of course, we recently announced the beta for V-Ray for Unreal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're taking on all takers there.
Right.
V-Ray Next, beta 3. Is out, and that's, the launch is probably coming around the corner.
Right. I think this is probably going to be our last beta before we do the actual launch.
I've learned from the development side that there's never, you might squeeze in another one.
Yeah.
And then FMX, of course, is right around the corner. We've got V-Ray Days happening there, and some good speakers. It just seems like this is... this is the time when a lot of stuff happens right before summer.
There is a lot of stuff going on, obviously, and you can check out all of that information at chaosgroup.com. Go to our events section, and you'll see all the events going on there. But just to give people a bit of an appetite of what's going to be happening at Total Chaos, who's going to be there? I know Ian Spriggs is going to be a speaker there, which is exciting.
Yeah, in fact, we were showing some of his digital human stuff at the booth. It's amazing.
Yeah, and who else is going to be there?
We've got a huge lineup coming in. I think we've got some guys from MangaVision and all the names are escaping me because
Bottleship will be there. Yeah, those are really cool guys. We did a podcast with them before. Kevin Margol, I think, was going to be there as well. Miguel, right?
Yep.
So
talking about the Nino
project. So we're gonna have some really great speakers there. And it's sort of split up between the art and the science and the technology side. So it's sort of, which will be really exciting. I'm excited about it. I haven't, this is going to be a big event for us and hope to have many more like it. And it's exciting, exciting. All right, guys, that's all we have. Hopefully you will enjoy this great podcast with Sébastien de Guy.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
We just came out of your talk, and it was really cool to see that. And a lot of what you talked about was randomness, right?
Yeah.
And I am reminded of a story. I have a mathematics background. So in college, I studied math, and one of my professors asked a question to a bunch of the students in the class, and he said, all right, and joking, he's like, give me a really random number between 1 and 20, right?
Yeah.
And so just the idea of saying really random brings up a bunch of things that you think of in terms of what randomness is.
Yeah.
And it turns out that when people said that, about half the room said 17.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
Because there was, you know, no one would pick an even number.
Yeah.
No one would pick a single digit number.
Yeah.
You know, 19 is too close to 20. Yeah. 13 has implication. 11 is two ones together.
Yeah, exactly.
15 is a multiple of five. And so 17 was the most logical random number.
There you go.
And so why is it that our brain does that? And why is it that it's so hard for us to come up with random numbers?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But I think it's an evolutionary thing.
Right.
Because if we were to, I think, I have no proof in that at all.
Okay.
Right? But I think it's an evolutionary thing where, like, the true random generators out there that were human died. And so they could not reproduce. And they died because maybe some of their choices were indeed not weighted enough towards like the safe bet. See what I mean? So maybe
right.
They died because they made the choice of 13, and that at that time was meaning like a jump off the cliff.
Right.
And okay, it was just random.
Right.
And so I think part of it is due to that. And that means that they, by having this bias, mm-hmm. we were more inclined in like picking up like the things that make the most sense. So we're bringing meaning and how do you say that? Sorry, meaning to your choices basically.
Right.
So that's my interpretation.
But you do. So basically, you are making, instead of randomness, you're making a choice of randomness.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's a really
interesting. Weighted randomness,
choice.
Or
right.
you're following the distribution. Also, there are things that, like for instance, a line, like you here in the UK compared to France,
mm-hmm.
There are a lot of lines when you just want to go to the underground, for instance, you have a line for you to get your ticket, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this line, when you analyze it, I remember, if I'm reminding correctly, it was perfectly described with a poisson law. It was not like, it wasn't a Gaussian, it was
mm-hmm.
a poisson.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's at stake here, what's going on. So not only do we in our minds don't make pure random choices,
right.
but also nature is that way, and maybe I'm going too far now, but one thing that got me interested, interested me very, very much like lately was I read this book by Max Tegmark,
mm-hmm.
Who's a scientist at MIT,
mm-hmm.
Cosmologist, mm-hmm. super, super high, super brainy guy, and his book was called, it's called Our Mathematical Universe,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it's awesome. I strongly recommend anyone to read
okay.
it. And of course, I'm interested in math, so
I'm
inclined to read that type of books. But anyway, in that book, maybe one of the strongest, one of the things that struck me the most was the realization. I did not realize it before, but the realization that the Schrodinger's equations, as far as I understood, there is no randomness element to it. So that means that if you know for sure the position of particles at any time by following the Schrodinger's equations, you are capable of saying, well, they will be there at that time, and then they will be that other position in a billion years from now.
Right.
If they were by themselves in the universe, right?
Right.
But there are so many particles that obviously it's complicated to compute. But in theory, if you had an infinitely intelligent mathematician and an infinitely capable computer, you'd be able to know exactly the future.
To predict anything.
Exactly. And that actually struck me. I was like, what's the, come on. Don't tell me this, because that brought me back to this accident.
Right.
I told you about during that this presentation I gave like just a few minutes ago,
mm-hmm.
where I would I got like caught in a car accident, right? And
right.
then my head hurt.
Head injury.
Mm-hmm. And then my brain started to grow bigger. And what happens is that there is a disconnect between happening. That can be like, in my case, it was like temporary, mm-hmm. but a disconnect between the short-term memory and long-term memory. And what that means is that you have a buffer in your short-term memory that says, okay, I have maybe 3 minutes of buffer. Mm-hmm. And then after that, because I didn't store what happened in this past 3 minutes in my long-term memory, I don't remember. So I start over, basically.
Right.
And so that what happened to me, I got this head injury. And started behaving like exactly like the character in this movie called Memento.
Right.
And this is where I started to get interested in how we are behaving, what's randomness really, because my father would tell me at the hospital waiting for the MRI.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot even imagine the state he was in at mm-hmm. that time, like just with his son.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So he told me that I would ask, like, where am I? What happened?
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I would ask the same question, and eventually I would say the same joke, like something like, it always happened to me, I'm or whatever, I'm always...
So your three-minute buffer you had, okay,
yeah.
What's interesting is that you followed the same logic every
exactly.
time.
Exactly. And that when I realized this, first I started to realize it like the day after.
Right.
And so I started to freak out, because really I thought, well, whoa, my brain is fucked.
Right.
And but then when again I realized, plus my friends and my family told me, yeah, you were doing this, I started to really question myself. I questioned how predictable I was,
right.
How unpredictable I was, in fact,
mm-hmm.
and how much a zombie I was. Mm-hmm. And that was killing me. And so I started studying random processes, and I went to my then to become PhD advisor at the time, who was a mathematician back in France,
mm-hmm.
and would ask him, what is randomness? Does that exist? And he said, well, welcome, finally. You're asking the right question.
Right.
We don't know. But but now reading that in that book from Max Tegmark, that the Schrodinger's equations are deterministic, I felt like, whoa, wait a minute. Maybe it's too much for me to swallow right now.
So. Right. But there is, even on a computer,
yeah.
there is no true randomness.
No. Oh, no, it's not.
Because randomness is based on a set of numbers that you give a seed.
Yeah, exactly.
And you get a number. But it is basically a set of numbers that have an order to them,
yeah,
already.
Exactly. It's a series. It's a mathematical function that gives you a number,
right.
from one.
Right.
From U0, you obtain U1 billion.
Right.
And but you always obtain the same U1 billion,
right.
from that same one, U0.
Right.
So this is why in computers there is no true randomness.
Right.
Indeed. Yeah.
So it was one of the first things I realized when I was a kid, and we were, you know, we had a, I think it was the first, like an IBM PC, and we were doing our own little programming and a random number generator, and he was thinking about it, and he goes, well, wait a minute, it's the same number every time. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, but so what you do is you start by giving it a seed. And it's like, okay, so we'll have to put a random seed every time. And he goes, you can do that, or you can just say, start from the amount of time of seconds that the computer was on,
yeah,
which could be random number because you don't know how long the computer has been on. And that's a great way of doing it. So just these thoughts, because I remember this is the first time I was like, there is no such thing as random. But this, the concept of random, and this is, I want to sort of get, this is what I'm getting at. The concept of random is actually quite beautiful,
mm-hmm.
as you described, and this part is the foundation really of what your company is, and mm-hmm. about finding beauty in randomness.
Yeah.
And the first time that I saw it was, then I was thinking about it, was obviously way back when we're looking at the things like the Mandelbrot set and different yeah. fractals and mm-hmm. the books on chaos theory yeah. and all of that. There is actually huge amounts of patterns that you see in randomness,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So what? Tell me a little bit about your PhD. That, you know, obviously, as you came out of this and you started asking very interesting questions that came out of traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. To me, it came out of, like, you know, goofing around on a computer. Mm-hmm. But tell me how that influenced your PhD and what came out of that, that you saw these patterns.
So I went to see that guy who would become then my PhD advisor.
Mm-hmm.
He's a mathematician. His name is Albert Benassi.
Mm-hmm.
He's a mathematician, and he was working at the time on the wavelet decomposition of Gaussian processes.
Okay. Right?
So it was really pure math. So I started working with him, and he wanted to see if there were applications to this pure math, so applied math, basically.
Applied math.
So I started working on that, and so the idea was to say, well, what if we take this mathematical representation, which was wavelet-based and which was new at the time,
mm-hmm.
To represent this self-similar, this fractals, right? So that
right.
we can see in nature. And at the time, it was very well thought that, say, well, when I look at the clouds, if I look at part of that cloud, it looks exactly like the same cloud if I zoom in a little bit, right? So there is a scaling factor. There is a between this part of the cloud and the whole cloud, it's only a scaling issue, a scaling thing. And if you input like a fractal dimension there, you can represent a lot of things in nature that Euclidean geometry has a hard time dealing with. So,
okay.
Right? So that was the idea. So I started working on that, and actually... I started programming this mathematical model and say, well, let's see what it can produce.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the theory and I implemented it, and I did actually a mistake
okay.
in implementing it, because I, instead of having three wavelet functions in 2D for creating these 2D noises, in 1D you have one wavelet function. In 2D you're supposed to have three wavelet functions, and in 3D you're supposed to have seven.
Okay.
And so instead of three, I just inputted one. I made a mistake. I didn't realize. I was like, shoot, I for generalizing. And mm-hmm. I mean, I made a mistake, right?
Right.
But so it generated stuff that actually was looking interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And my PhD advisor was smart enough to say, wait a minute. This is interesting. This is not mathematically correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. Please keep going. Keep exploring this. So I kept exploring this,
mm-hmm.
and I started working on this and producing these noise functions. And because it was not wavelets, but this simple function actually was super important in the shape of the final texture. And so this is why I called it not a wavelet, but a morphlet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the morphlet was a morph, like the Greek root of shape.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a decomposition of processes along these morphlets. But it was not mathematically correct. It was not a mathematical basis. But
okay.
I won't get into the details. But it's fine. The thing is that I could have some... visceral intuitions on what wavelet, what morphlet to use to obtain this wood grain, this rough cast texture,
mm-hmm.
this fabric. So I could just see it my eyes and say, okay, now I use this function instead of that one and obtain something that was looking exactly like this. So I started to realize that this error led to a simpler way of inputting parameters to that model
mm-hmm.
that would lead to the recreation of synthesis of nice looking textures.
And right.
So that was the beginning of it. And in parallel, what happened was I was teaching Softimage 3D
mm-hmm.
a long time ago with two students. And I realized when I was teaching that when you were in this, what was the phase? But I can't remember. There was a phase in the tool where you would work on the materials and the textures.
Right.
And the noise functions I would find in there were like limited compared to what I could produce with my prototype that was error based, right?
Right.
So this is where I started to say, well, okay, maybe there is something to do that actually is at the intersection of two of my passions, one being movies, cinema. I tried to enter the to become a director before starting my PhD.
Right. Actually,
I got rejected, so I was first at my my school, math school, so mm-hmm. I got a grant from the ministry. Anyway, ministry research. Anyway, I got there. So I thought maybe there is a nice cross-section between this mathematical model and an application in a field that I love, which is computer graphics. Mm-hmm. So I pushed it this way and got remarked.
It's only a mistake in the sense that you used one wavelength instead of three wavelengths, right? Mm-hmm. That was the mistake you made.
Yeah.
But somehow in that field, you felt you gained more control.
Exactly.
Over other things. Now, you also, I mean, obviously you've had enough experience in this that you could see the function.
Yeah.
And you knew what to change to say, if I do this, it will turn into wood. If I do this, it'll turn into that. That's kind of amazing to see that, because looking at a function.
Yeah, but when actually.
You had enough experience in it, I guess.
Actually, not really. We will have experience looking at things, right?
Right.
I mean, my kids, they don't look at things anymore. They look at the screen of my phone anymore. Mm-hmm. That's it. But
right.
But when you're looking at things, when you look hard enough, you can see that this wood grain, for instance, like the normal map, if I look at the normal map, I'm looking mm-hmm. at the table now mm-hmm. where we're right. talking. If you look at the normal map, you see these little holes that you cannot see it's not in the colors. It's really like the
reflection,
the varnish and the reflection, right. exactly, mm-hmm. that you only see that. So maybe it's part of only that map. And then, like the way the grain, the woods made is, you have these stretched, patterns. Mm-hmm. So if I take a very simple stretched pattern, then I apply it randomly. I don't have that much information if I get too close. So maybe at that stage of the tree, I stop, etc. So that was how I would build it. But yeah, this error led me to the thing that made it manageable in mm-hmm. terms of complexity for a brain.
Okay.
And this is where actually I got convinced for the first time that you need to take into account the artist when you present procedural tools. Because if you give an artist something that does everything for him, that's great, but that's not enough.
Okay.
The artist has to control it to some degree.
Right.
And so it's very important for what everything we do at Algorithmic when we push a program to say, well, you can go full manual now if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you can start from there. You can get help from the procedures. But you're not stuck with it. It's not zero or one. It's a hybrid way of working. And
right.
really the input of the artist and the input of the human guy here is super important.
So, and I've seen other, I mean, the tools of Algorithmic, you have two main ones. You have Substance Designer and you have Substance Painter, right?
Yeah.
So Designer is really one of the places where you get to play with your procedurals and do all kinds of interesting shaders and connect them and outputs of different types. And then Painter is more of a 3D painting application that allows us to do more detailed decals and it works in the UV space, et cetera. Yeah. That's what, as much as I understand. It seems mm-hmm. I got it right.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, you got it right.
Great. Now, there have been other tools that have created procedural shaders in the past or procedural textures, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I have never seen one that has sort of captured the market as well mm. as the one that you have created.
Yeah.
And what is it do you think that the artist saw that made it such an aha moment for them mm. compared to other ones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question for which I don't have like a very, very specific answer. I think it's a mix of things, but one is two things actually. One is the industry changed at some point to, the industry, the game development studios switched to PBR. Mm-hmm. So all game engines said from one day to the other, okay, now for the next game, we won't be producing textures the same way we used to do before. Okay. So it's not diffuse plus specular plus normal map anymore.
Okay.
It's going to be albedo plus roughness plus metallic.
Okay.
Plus normal. So normal was the same. Height map was the same, but it was not used. But then what's the difference between albedo and diffuse? What is the difference between roughness, specular? What is metallic? Mm-hmm. And so basically what happened is that at that time it happened, the artists in game development studios had to redo their work, right? So they had to look at new ways of producing it, and we were ready because it was super easy as an output for Substance Designer to say, well, now instead of outputting a diffuse map and specular, here is what you need to do to output albedo, roughness, metallic, right? And also we implemented very quickly a viewer that was PBR so that it was following the same rules.
Same logic.
GGX mm-hmm. from Disney.
Yep.
BRDF. And so basically what we did is that we say, okay, we're ready, we're here. So as soon as these guys started to look at potential tools that would help them in the process, we were ready. So that was the first step. And then the second step was, because we'd been playing with it for so long, actually, without it being picked up, really, it was like very, very small niche at the mm-hmm. beginning. But then when that happened, we were ready. The tool was super advanced.
Right.
And so what you could find in there was already like out of the box, super ready. Mm-hmm. And then it got picked up by super smart people at Naughty Dog, people at Ubisoft.
Yeah.
And these guys started producing.
So the game industry really was the one that gravitated towards
it. Yeah, it worked that way for us, yes.
Right.
And so the guys at Naughty Dog and guys at Ubisoft started using it and producing like amazing stuff.
Well, there's another thing, and I think this is something that I think was very important, and you mentioned it a little bit in your talk. Procedural textures and stuff used to look like procedural textures.
Yes.
They used to look like mathematical functions,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And you could always tell this. Yep. Now, I know, for example, one of my supervisors that I work with, his name is Eric Barba, and if he's listening, he can mm-hmm. think about this. But he, this is a long time ago, he directed us never to use procedurals on certain things because he didn't like the look of it to look like mathematical stuff, right? Yeah. And that's changed. There's something that's changed in the way that we look at things, that procedurals do have a much more natural look to them that they used to. What's the change there that happened?
Well, I like to think that one aspect is we used a way of generating the texture that was explicit instead of implicit. The good old, the other tools that were procedural texture tools mm-hmm. were using a lot of implicit techniques. Let's say for one given pixel, compute a full function that gives me the color of that pixel.
Okay.
So it's implicit because you don't store anything. You can just call upon that value and call upon that engine, gives you the value back.
Right.
And whereas in our case, it's explicit. And one of the reasons behind it is because the math we use, actually, when I broke the mathematical model, the wavelet decomposition, I went full steam. So I said, okay, now that it's broken, I can break it completely, which means that the tree that is describing the space mm-hmm. we're coding and we're generating the noise upon actually is moving. So all the parts are moving, can move, can evolve in space.
Right.
It means that for one given pixel, maybe you have two paths or maybe more in the tree that gets you to that value. So that means that you cannot say for one given pixel, go back and follow the tree back and get the final result. So you have to compute more. And so in the end, we ended up having to saying, well, you want to compute a fixed resolution image. And this is an explicit way of generating it. And so you obtain a final image. It's a bitmap image in the end. But it's been generated procedurally, but it's a bitmap at the end.
Okay.
But that thing made it so that actually when you get free of some of the constraints of the implicit way of computing things, mm-hmm. you actually can produce way more interesting stuff.
Okay.
Like you can look at the surrounding values, for instance, mm-hmm. and do blurs, stuff like this.
Right.
You can do warps. You can do operations, very complex operations like this. And we realized, we quickly realized that you could come up. It was a way more powerful way of, I mean, way more, how do you say that, extensive power. I mean, I don't know how to say it in English properly, but basically you could produce more. You were less limited. So that actually helped people saying, well, okay, I don't care, because at the end it's a bitmap. But in games, it was less important because they would use bitmaps anyway. They were not using procedural textures in the good old way, like implicit procedural textures.
Right.
They were using bitmaps either way.
Because implicit one means there was no resolution, be infinite resolution.
No, exactly. Right. It was a set of bitmaps. They needed a set of bitmaps. So that limitation that we imposed to ourselves was not a big issue for the game developers.
Because they needed to have a
texture. They needed to have bitmaps anyway. And that limitation on one side was traded against more freedom on the other side and more creative freedom. And that's actually what I think led to what you can see now in what all the guys like Josh Lynch and Brad Smith and Virgilio and like this deity and Nicola and Gaetan, my side, my team. So all these guys are producing like crazy, incredible stuff that looks even more natural than some said are not natural. So, but because part of it is because it's due to that, I think. And now, maybe now, what's happening is that it just freed people to say, okay, oh, wow, it's possible. But and now they are into it, and maybe they are using the same techniques as the old ones. Within our tools, because it's a subset of what our tools can do.
Right.
But more people are using it, so that means that more people, more brains are onto the problem, so the more creative stuff happens because of that.
But isn't that also some? I mean, I know that it's always when you're working with random tools and stuff, procedural information, it's incredibly creatively rewarding, right? Because when you're dealing with non-random things, this is a very manual process. And you have to build and build and build. And it's like, envision in my head is this. And it's like, oh, but I got to do that. But the other one is a lot more freeing, where you sort of allow some of the randomness to influence your decision, but you can just, it just happens in a lot of ways. And, you know, there's that horrible term called happy accidents, but it's not just happy accidents. It's a constant evolution. And when you have a lot of artists that do this, you get a huge wealth of stuff, of material that people can work with. So do you give, do artists, you know, contribute back to the community and give that stuff?
This is a very good point, because indeed, when you actually paint a bitmap, you're not contributing to the overall knowledge of the humanity.
Right.
You're contributing to your own knowledge and your own experience.
Right.
But in the case of procedural techniques, indeed, it's stored. The recipe is stored somewhere,
right.
And yes, the community is giving back a lot, actually, because we have something called Substance Share. Substance Share is a platform where you can upload your stuff and give it away for free to everyone interested. We've had, I don't know how many millions of downloads already of assets on Substance.
That's amazing.
Substance Share. It is. Great. I mean, it's incredible, and the amount of, I mean, the very variety of stuff you can find there, and the quality of stuff you can find there is super interesting. Also, we have something called Substance Source that we at Algorithmic produce ourselves, and when you get access to Substance Source, not only do you get access to the file you can use as them as is, right, but you also can obtain the graphs, so you can learn from our guys. So it's a constantly evolving database of knowledge for the creation of digital digital materials is growing because of us, because of the community, and it's stored somewhere and accessible. So yeah, that in itself is awesome. I like it.
But you bring up an excellent point, because I know that, you know, there's a lot of similarities, and you even mentioned, you know, you give a lot tribute to the guys from Side Effects who won their Oscar this year. Not just a SciTech award, they won an actual Oscar because of how important procedural information is in the industry of computer graphics. But I do know that pricking up Houdini as an artist is an extremely challenging task, right? And there's a lot of similarities in terms of philosophy between what you guys are doing in Substance and what goes on in Houdini. Obviously, Houdini there's a lot of modeling and other things that you guys are not doing in the same way. How, besides the, what you just described as giving people examples, graphs to work on,
yeah.
how, what was your philosophy in terms of making Substance Designer an easy tool for people to yeah. operate, that they could just create things very quickly?
It's a very good question. We've tried as hard as we could,
mm-hmm.
And to some degree we failed because now I know that it's a battle you don't want to fight, because
okay.
it's basically if you spread people on an axis of likeness for technical things.
Mm-hmm.
The guys that are the most inclined to go for these type of things, they're less numbers than the guys not interested in that.
Right.
And so you can fight as much as you want. Some people would just say, well, no, I'm not interested. So it's the good old adoption curve, basically.
Right.
And so what we did instead is we realized this and we say, okay, well, let's go full steam geeky on that tool, and that's fine. And Houdini is doing that super well. Substance Designer is doing that super well. There is no reason in us changing it. But at some point when people were saying, well, you know what would be awesome in Substance Designer would be a 3D painting feature.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, okay, let's implement it. But we started implementing it. I mean, we thought it'd be a feature of Substance Designer first, but very quickly, due to technical reason and to the reason, most importantly, the reason that these are not the same people, we decided to make a different tool out of it, and this is what became Substance Painter.
Right.
And Substance Painter is actually our answer to that.
Okay.
We just basically said, okay, you have your more left brain type of guy, or mm-hmm. more right brain type of guy. It's mm-hmm. fine.
Right.
Of course, some people are both.
Right.
But it's a very limited number even.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up putting a lot of effort in making Substance Painter something more accessible. And actually next week, we're releasing maybe a new next week at GDC.
Well, this will come out later. So if you, you know,
okay.
So you can talk about it if you like to. And I'll clear it with you before I release
GDC,
it.
Yeah. At GDC, we released this new version of Substance Painter,
right.
which is way simpler to use, with new UX, new UI. We've been putting a lot of effort on that. But basically, because the users of Substance Painter are really, really into like experience, they want to have as little barriers between what they have in their minds and what they can produce.
Mm-hmm.
So the technical barriers are barriers.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can remove some of them, it's fine. And what with Substance Painter, what we did is we haven't dropped our procedural, technical, geeky DNA. We've turned it into stuff that is in there, that is accessible, that is helping the gesture of the artist, but not like replacing, not something that you have to go through. You can go full manual on Substance Painter and have as much fun as you would have in other tools.
Right.
But you can, if you want, you can get some help from techniques and tools and digital materials that can be actually defined with Substance Designer.
Mm-hmm.
And in teams now, what we see is that, let's say, 1 out of 10 guys is using Substance Designer and the 9 out of 10 are using Substance Painter.
Mm.
And I'm glad we did that, because it's complicated indeed. And complicated doesn't mean we need to change it. That I realized lately, actually. Because it's actually appealing to people liking stuff that can be hard to master.
Right.
Easy to learn is different. And actually, when you're wired in such a way that you understand the graph, the process,
mm-hmm.
it's super easy to pick up. Substance Designer is super easy to pick
up
already.
Right. But there is what I find interesting is you also mentioned several different industries that have picked it up. Obviously, There was a technology shift in the gaming industry that allowed you guys to be at the right place at the right time. Like
yeah.
we're ready with PBR, and they're like, oh, this is that, because they didn't know how they're gonna handle painting anymore.
Yeah.
With there was a new lighting technique, but other places have also picked up. Obviously, the film industry is picking up a little bit here and there, which I'm sure they're going to pick up a lot more. It's going to mm-hmm. pick up a lot of steam because of how good it is. But then you have the architecture community.
Yeah.
Now I used to be an architect, so I mm-hmm. know for a fact that this is a community that is not technical.
Mm-hmm.
not technical at all,
yeah.
but somehow they have embraced some of the things that you guys have done where
yeah.
they don't want to scan wood anymore. They don't want to scan fabrics anymore.
Yeah.
They can recreate these digitally and probably make them look even better mm-hmm. through procedurals. How do you feel that that industry has picked it up?
Yeah, to be fair, it's the one we have the most trouble with right now. Yeah, because it's way more fragmented. What we see is that you have less. I mean, the goal of the final thing is not the image itself. It's the building or the apartment or the
right.
interior. So it's only a mean to an end. It's not the end, mm-hmm. and that means that teams are less organized for producing these images
oh, yeah.
than in other industries.
Sure.
And also at the design phase, it doesn't happen that much because we're having a lot of success in industrial design because during the design phase, as I was explaining during my talk, mm-hmm. you want to have these materials look. I mean, be part of the design process itself.
Right. So you want to say this is a leather. This is
yeah,
a,
exactly. This,
right.
Let's say the interior of your car. You want to test out several materials while you actually design it.
Yep.
So the design teams are picking a substance for that task. So mm-hmm. this is where we have less issues, and then they use it again when they want to visualize. Obviously.
Right.
But for architecture, it's only during visualization time, or mostly, not only,
so
of
it's
course,
at the end of the process.
At the end of the process, and less important, less organized. So we have a hard time there. But that being said, now we have like people at Scott DeWitty, at Gensler.
Yeah, I know Scott.
We have people at Foster, people at like huge firms like this are you starting to use substance because they mm-hmm. see it as a receptacle of everything that they're doing. Mm-hmm. Substance designer, when they scan material, they want to have databases of scan materials. When they scan materials, actually the best tool for processing these scan materials is actually Substance Designer.
Okay.
It's the best tool out there because you have all these processes. Instead of having these noise functions at the beginning, you have these input images and then you can process them
right.
using techniques that are image-based that are well-described within Substance Designer.
That's really cool.
So you can use that already. And also they start picking up integrations or plugins for Unreal Engine, for mm-hmm. instance. We see it a lot used there mm-hmm. For 3ds Max.
Yep.
So in combination with V-Ray, with like integrations in other DCC apps, basically.
Right.
So they use this. They use also Substance Source, Substance Share, everything mm-hmm. they can find there. So the content, the plugins, they play a bit with the parameters. And they want to go crazy, they use Substance Designer to mm-hmm. actually manage, scan, process, and author their own materials.
Right. But I think there's actually what's starting to happen, and you mentioned it a bit in your talk, is what's happening a lot in terms of the design process of architecture is use of parametrization,
yeah.
right? A lot of that. Patrick Schumacher, who is now Zaha Hadid, unfortunately she died, so Patrick yeah. took over. What's the term he used? Not parametrization. I'm name blocking.
Inverse.
No. He has another word for it. But it's essentially the idea of the randomization of techniques and creating form out of some of these algorithms.
Yeah.
That's actually becoming more and more popular.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the very popular tools that people are using in 3D is something called Grasshopper. Which is not dissimilar than what you're doing.
I love it. Yeah, it's great.
But as a 3D application, more as a modeling technique. So there is a lot of crossover because I think that what people are thinking about can come up to a form in a way that traditionally would have been much harder to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You know, Grasshopper is an awesome product.
Right.
And we don't see many, and people like Scott and also what's his name? I'm sorry, I don't remember. But
okay.
We had this great artist using Grasshopper and Substance in combination, actually. Mm-hmm. So we had him talk at Substance Day last year. Mm-hmm. Shame on me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but he basically we start to see more and more use of combined use of Substance Designer plus other procedural tools that create the geometry, the shape on top of which you apply the materials.
Right.
All of that you could do also in Houdini, and more artists actually just having fun producing crazy stuff on the internet,
mm-hmm.
on Instagram, are starting producing crazy videos,
mm-hmm.
using substance tools and playing with parameters, animating all these, taking into account, like, I don't know, stretch, mm-hmm. shape growing, and then modifying the texture according to that.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to rewire everything. And so, yeah, it's interesting. It's a very interesting trend. I totally see it growing. I don't see it like becoming the norm, because as I was saying before, mm-hmm. it remains complicated. It remains technical. And this is when in a team, you can have people mastering this, you will be ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure about that.
But there was something else that you mentioned as well, which I think was really great, is being able to create something that's incredibly complex inside of a very small program, right?
Yeah.
Right. Now, I remember the demo scene
yeah.
that I used to talk about, and I think that's a great example of people that were saying, I want to create something really complicated, animation, music, colors,
yeah.
video, everything, inside of something that fits in 64K of data.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. And they would do that by leveraging as much mathematics as possible,
yeah.
And being very, very efficient in their coding. That gave birth to a lot of stuff. But it's also really nice that, you know, you're in the example you said, you can create all of these really complicated 8K maps of this texture
yeah.
inside of a file that's basically just 184K.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what... Do you find that efficiency is it because it's like the seed of the thing that's going to create the long map, right?
Yeah, it's actually it's something fascinating to me, like this data amplification,
right?
How from very little information you're capable of producing this huge amount of content,
right?
Of stuff, and basically. Again, back this book from Max Tegmark is talking about that again. If we're indeed living in the realization of a mathematical model, maybe we only need a few bytes or a few kilobytes or a few megabytes
to recreate
everything from scratch. And that's we're getting crazy here.
No, but, well, yes and no, because I mean. If that's not true, then or how would the Big Bang really happen? Because we have to be contained inside a very small space.
Yeah,
right?
It was super small at the beginning, yes,
right.
For sure. But so, it's fascinating anyway. It gives me vertigo when I think about it.
Sure. Yeah, I bet. There is something else that I think is there was another book that you mentioned in your talk, which was.
Secret Knowledge.
Secret
by
Knowledge.
David Hockney, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Explain a little bit that book and how it influenced things and what your ideas of what was going on. This is related to tools and art, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Secret Knowledge, especially, it's a book by David Hockney, who's an artist himself,
mm-hmm.
A painter, a famous painter. He lives in the UK, actually. And mm-hmm. he in his book, is basically saying, well, he's basically proving
mm-hmm.
a point has been making, which is at the turn of, if I'm not mistaken, of the 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that's the right number. There was some kind of a tipping point
mm-hmm.
in the quality of what could be obtained, what we could see in paintings, mm-hmm. especially in the renderings of like complex stuff like geometry. Fabrics and reflections and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically, in his book, he proves the thing and say, well, okay, look at after and look before and after, look again before and after, what's happening here, what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first part of the book, the second part of the book is all the letters he would send back and forth between him and several people, like challenging or going with him along this line.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that was the second part of the book. The first part of the book can be read in maybe 1 hour, and basically mm-hmm. says, okay, we have proofs. And for instance, in that painting which painting was it? Was it from Vermeer?
Vermeer.
Basically, there's a painting with a girl with the milk thing. And basically, he says, well, if you look carefully here, I have a proof it's been optics-based because like these reflections here are blurred.
Right.
So he painted depth of field.
Right.
So he painted depth of field there. He painted basically what the camera obscura was projecting onto this wall.
Including chromatic aberration.
Including chromatic aberration, including that kind of stuff. So he was basically, and also he was also proving that in some paintings you would have like two different, how do you call that? The lines, the points of direction.
The vanishing points.
Oh, exactly.
Right.
So you would have two different ones.
Right.
Because the system they were using was too small to contain everything. So they would do it two times, but the second time was like fake. It was not exactly aligned with the first one.
Right.
And so you could prove that it was happening that way, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. So basically it's a very, very fundamental book about art and tools and art.
Okay.
And how the advent of optics at that time, which corresponds to that time where paintings got way, way better and way more realistic.
Have you seen Tim Vermeer?
Yes, exactly. It's the same idea. Same idea. This is a great movie. I love that movie.
Yeah, yeah, it's really good.
And knowing that, by the way, he's from our industry, isn't
he? He's the guy who invented Lightwave. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And his painting, I don't know if there's he made a painting. And for those who don't know, it's a documentary. It's available on Netflix if you have Netflix. And it's Tim Jensen, I think is his last name.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah. But he's the guy who invented Lightwave. And he had a theory for same concept that you were just describing, that Vermeer was actually using a camera obscura method. And he reverse engineered what he thought was the camera, set up a scene that was very almost the same as one of his paintings, and tried to manually paint his own Vermeer, and created the same thing. And it took him almost a year.
Yeah,
it was crazy. And he's not a painter, right? Nope, he's a computer programmer, but he created a very, very compelling Vermeer.
He did it.
And not only that, but I was going to say that he followed since that documentary, his painting. His Vermeer is in a museum in New Zealand.
Is it really?
Yeah, I didn't know that. It is in a museum. It's a really interesting museum. And everyone's like, oh, it's a Vermeer. And they think it's a Vermeer. And he's like, nope, it's an experiment on a Vermeer. So it's really fascinating. But yeah, I think that that these tools and the way they enable us to do things, I'll just put it this way. I don't think it's cheating.
No, me neither.
And people would say that's cheating because you're just tracing a photograph.
Yeah.
But it's not. No. In the same way that I can't say that taking a photograph is cheating from taking a portrait.
Exactly.
Right? It's about composition, about your eye, and it's about stuff like that.
No, exactly. Exactly. Right. And it explains it very well as well. Basically, at some point, photography happens, right?
Right.
So it's invented. And then what happens is that the painters lose interest in these techniques because like a photograph is way faster to do than the painting using these techniques, right? So they lose interest in that. And what they do then is that they get interested in new movements, new ways of representing reality.
Right.
And so you have new painters and new techniques happening.
Pointillism.
Exactly.
Cubism,
exactly. All this. Yep. And it becomes because it happens because at some point one of the tools replaces one of the techniques that they were using. But I agree with you. It's not cheating at all. It's to me the work of the true artist. What is a true artist? What is true randomness? I don't know. But the work of the artist is to know the tools it's using as well. Or sometimes even some people say they should create their own tools the same way some painters are aware. Creating their own brushes and their own colors and paint material, right?
Right.
Some people say, well, the use of optics, they invent in their own technique, and that's fine. It was part of their job.
Right.
And today, when you think about it, renderer is exactly something that does that for you.
Right.
It does part of the job for you, but the
creativity.
The true creativity still is in the artist's eyes and mind and heart and brain at some point, right? How to convey it is using different tools. That's fine, but it's not cheating to me.
No, it's not cheating. And I think it's very important to think, to realize that there has always been, always been a link between art and technology. And of course, mathematics has always, you know, they used, let's go even back to the Renaissance, right? When they started using mathematics to develop perspective.
Exactly.
That's not cheating.
No.
No. It was just a really much more accurate way. And it's like, oh, that looks more realistic, right? Yeah, and so these, all of these techniques have evolved over time.
Yeah.
And that bridge between technology and math is, I think, really, or technology and art has always been a big one.
And I think it's great to be in this industry. What we're doing in our companies is, I like to think that anyway, but I really like this idea of helping, to some degree, helping the artists of the new generation producing more, producing better, producing differently with our tools.
Right.
And I really enjoy thinking that Substance has played a role in, like, the birth of games like Uncharted 4.
Right.
Because it's been genre defining. There's been a before and after that game. There will be a before and after other production that's been using V-Ray, Substance, and all the tools, Houdini, etc.
Well, I know for a fact that, like, Vlado loves coding. He loves coming up with really great ideas. But the one thing that he loves even more is to see what people have done with what
he does. Exactly. I so much shared vision. Yeah, it's amazing to see what they're doing.
He's just that, you know, because he knows he's not an artist, right? So the best he's going to do is a teapot on a plane or something. I'm not joking. He does more than that. But he doesn't, that's not his job. His job is to do this. But then he takes it's like, you show me what you can do with this is a really inspiring thing.
Yeah.
And there's great things that makes our life easier, makes our creativity more enjoyable, a lot of other things.
So exactly.
I think it's really cool.
And I think it's really, really cool that the SciTech Awards do exist.
Right.
For that specific reason.
Right.
It's recognizing the impact of tools.
Yeah, I think a lot. I don't think people don't realize that the Academy is actually a science academy in a lot of ways, and that's why we exist. And the whole film industry is based on science.
It is.
Right?
It's cheating just to use, like, a film, right?
Right. Yeah.
At some point, but no, it's not. It's a new way of expressing things.
And I think it's great that little happy accidents like what you came up with have inspired you to do what you have done and given the tools and expanded the use of where procedurals can go. So it's really great to do that. Well, we're coming up towards the end here, so I want to make sure that you have enough time to, because I know you've got to catch a train back to Paris.
Yeah.
Give us an idea a little bit about more about, you know, the length of the company, where it's going, a little bit of the links, and where do you feel that you want to go in the future? What are some of the things that inspire you?
Yeah. So we're growing a lot.
Oh, great.
Yeah. We're more than 110 people now.
Wow.
Now, yeah.
And you've got many offices now, right?
We have like nine official offices.
Really?
Now. Yeah. All over the world.
Wow.
And we just opened one in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
We're opening one in India. And India is becoming a very, very big market for us.
Actually, right.
It's interesting what's happening there.
Right.
We're growing, doing super well.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do, if you ask me what I want to do, I want to keep doing cool stuff. Because when I started the company, I was reflecting about it. Because sometimes people ask me to talk at business schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear all these blogs, all these podcasts about like all these founders and all the good advices they give. And it's interesting because when I started, really, I really, really just wanted to do cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much it. Like, success was, I didn't even care, and I was lucky enough so that I was doing well. Maybe I was not in a hurry to be successful or something like this. So maybe it's something.
But I have found that if people do stuff that they enjoy, their success will find them, not necessarily in the same way that they think success will be.
Yeah.
But that people will enjoy what you do, and they're you'll find that there's a lot of people that say, I want to be as happy as that person is.
Yes. Yeah. No, exactly. And I've seen that. Actually, my father, for instance, was an entrepreneur. I mean, he's not an entrepreneur, he was a plumber, but he had his own company. And
right.
And the way he was doing it was like, I would see him like happy and I would see his employees happy. I would see his clients happy. That was good. That was a good example. So I wanted to be at the head of, driving my own stuff because this is what I wanted to do. I've always been like a entrepreneurial to some. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always been creating a lot of stuff, and it was like crazy when I was young. I was trying out everything, but anyway, I was doing all these type of things. But so I wanted to be free to do cool stuff. Mm-hmm. That was my main objective, and like success, money, etc., was secondary. It was not something that was not important, but it was really secondary.
Right,
and so. So we're growing. Anyway, going back to where we're at now, what I want to keep doing is having fun and do cool stuff and have fun doing that. So, right. So obviously, if I want to give you a bit more details, I want to say that we really want to push Substance Painter as the Photoshop. Like the equivalent of Photoshop used to be for digital images, for digital assets, mm-hmm. 3D assets. And so for this, we need to take into account more stuff incoming, like how to make it easier to get into the tool, mm-hmm. to get your 3D stuff, 3D mesh. If it's not like if it doesn't have UVs, for instance, we need to take care of that.
Right,
we want to. We're working on that. Mm-hmm. If at the end of the process you just want to showcase your work, and a lot of our users actually just want to showcase their art.
Right.
We need to have like a good way of rendering nice images and doing beauty shots out of these. So. Wink, wink. So at the beginning of the process, the end of the process, we know how we want to make it evolve. Maybe have more ways of manipulating the geometry itself.
Right. I'm sure you're probably looking at also using a lot more of some AI techniques and deep learning techniques.
A lot, yes.
And I know we don't have enough time to get into that because I'm sure that could be a whole other podcast.
Yes.
There's a lot of ways that I think that it's a great time to be involved in this industry right now.
Yeah.
And really
it's scary too.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what will happen. Everyone can disrupt everyone these days.
Yeah.
I think I have the feeling.
Yeah,
and we're big enough so that we can be disrupted ourselves. So
right,
I'm big into disruption because the same way I used to read a lot of. I mean, when I was a scientist, I used to read all these science books and all these very very precise papers and science papers. Now I'm reading. What I'm reading now is how to run a company that is. Bringing innovation to the table, and I just completed actually a few months back. I just completed something at I have a diploma from Stanford now.
Right. Oh wow.
On this subject.
On
exactly.
Business, right.
Yeah, exactly. Because I got so much interest. I mean, it's interesting. It is interesting. I mean, not everything, but some parts are really really interesting, and it's and you have to know that.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that one of the things I had to know was about disruption and disruption. I know the definition of disruption, really, what that means. And I'm really onto making sure that we don't get disrupted. And even I try for my team to disrupt itself somehow.
Right.
Right. We try to reinvent ourselves, even though we're big, we're getting bigger.
Mm-hmm.
We try to be super agile. We try to react quickly. We try to move quickly. So,
I think there's a really good book that you might enjoy called The Inevitable. Have you ever heard of this book?
This one, no, actually.
It's great. It's about the sort of the inevitable, what technology does and inevitably what it's going to lead to.
Oh, interesting.
It's really great to think about, and it talks a lot about AI and stuff like that. It's a really good book, and I highly recommend it. So
okay, great.
So we should look into that.
Yep.
Well, thanks a lot. I want to make sure you catch your train, so I'm going to cut it short.
Thank you.
But it was a really great conversation. Thanks so much, Sebastian.
Thank you. And
Chris,
I really enjoyed it.
If we want to, you know, if you have more to talk about later, let's make sure we stay in touch, and we can do another one.
I will, with pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.